I'm Evan Kleinman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm going to tell you how to make bread with a perfect crust and soft middle with hardly any effort on your part at all. Also, the artisan food movement meets salami, and boy, are we lucky. Close those cookbooks. It's time to cook with your intuition. Plus, what does good food have to do with Hollywood players? Apparently, not much. First, let's get to the farmer's market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. A lot of people have been asking lately, where's the asparagus and where are all those artichokes that Green Farms brings down from Lompoc? I was just speaking with Daisy Tamai, who runs the farm stand for Green Farms at several markets, and Daisy was telling me that basically the asparagus and artichokes are year-round crops. Phil has done a very good job of planting them in succession and harvesting them, but it's been so cold lately that the crops have really slowed down their production, so they've cut way, way, way back. And in fact, the asparagus was pretty much non-existent for a couple of weeks. But now they're back. They have a nice table full of asparagus and artichokes. They also have the baby purple and the baby green artichokes. The large globe artichokes, actually, Daisy tells me, are even more sensitive to the weather than the smaller ones. But you can get all your asparagus and artichokes now at the few markets that Green Farm is coming to. And I'm so happy today that Evan is here with me at the market, and we're eyeballing this great asparagus, and I know you're head is seething with great recipes. What are we going
to
do?
It's just so much fun to be here. Normally on Saturdays I'm in the studio, but I just decided to run out and come by and take a look. This is really a beautiful size of asparagus. It's the medium. It's not the really skinny spaghetti kind. It's not the really big, thick, luscious ones.
Jumbo.
But what I like to do with asparagus is really simple. I trim them down and I put them on a little sheet pan, like a cookie sheet pan, drizzle olive oil, salt, and pepper, and roast them. I love to roast them because, to me, grilling will often give you too much char on such a beautiful, sweet, spring sort of vegetable. And it doesn't take very long. I throw them in at like 450 degrees in a preheated oven. It usually takes maybe 10 to 15 minutes. You don't want to overcook them. You want them to still feel a little bit stiff when you take them out because they're going to hang on to the heat and then they're going to be perfect. And then once they're roasted, you can do anything. I tend to just eat them that way.
When you say trim them, do you do the snap technique where you just see where it snaps, where it gets from tender to tough?
That pastoral. I sort of just line them all up by their heads.
Okay.
Probably not too much more than an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter. You don't want to throw away more than you need to.
Exactly.
And the great thing about roasting them like that is that you can roast a lot all at once, keep them in the fridge, and then you can add them to salads. You can make a little bit of a citrus vinaigrette, which this time of year is so good. Grate a little bit of zest of your favorite citrus fruit and a nice mustardy vinaigrette and throw it on top with maybe a little bit of toasted pine nuts.
Some people peel asparagus.
Some people do. I'm lazy.
You don't. I guess. Okay.
I don't peel them.
Now, so let's talk about these nice tight heads.
Yeah. What you want to look for is you want to look for really, really closed tips, the asparagus tips. Once they start to open, it is a grass. It's a grass. And once they start to open, they're gone. They're blown out. And they don't taste that good either. They look beautiful. His always look really beautiful.
They do.
And these artichokes are really quite beautiful. And it's, unless I'm going to just steam an artichoke and eat it the old-fashioned way where you're ripping off the leaves and dipping them into some like delicious buttery or mayonnaise-y sauce and peeling them off with your teeth, I sort of forget about the globes and I go for the baby ones because then you can just trim the outside of the initial layer of leaves, cut them in half, and then you can see if there's a choke. If there's a little choke, just simply cut it out, and then you can braise them with tons of herbs and garlic and olive oil and just enough olive oil and water in equal parts. You know I'm an olive oil fiend. I cover it with parchment paper and bring it to a boil and then turn it down, and they are so quick. These that you buy fresh from the market cook really in about 7 minutes.
How do you tell? Do you tell by pulling off an outer leaf or by stabbing the whole thing with
I pierce the heart end with a little paring knife. And then they're done, and you can just let them cool down in the sauce. Or if you want, you can deep fry them in a nice little beer batter. Or you can cut them up and throw them into a pasta sauce, make a risotto with them.
When you say cover with parchment paper, are they so you don't put a lid on the pan?
No, you don't need to. I mean, I put parchment paper so it touches the vegetables, and what that does is it makes the whole process of the water condensing and then coming back down much faster, so it cooks faster. Sometimes I'll do the parchment paper and put a lid on too.
Are they submerged in this liquid?
They're not submerged. I'd say it comes halfway up.
Yeah, and what exactly is braising?
Well, braising, you usually are putting whatever it is you're cooking, be it a protein or a vegetable, in a liquid medium, and then you're cooking it usually for a longer period of time over a moderate heat. And most people think about braising meats, but vegetables braise beautifully.
What kind of herbs do you throw in with your artichokes?
Well, the typical way, which would be carciofi alla romana, which is artichokes Roman style, is Italian parsley. Right now I saw some green garlic, which would be just fabulous. Cut the whole green garlic up, including the tops. Mint, a nice, beautiful, mild mint, like that Persian mint I saw over at Coleman's stand. And basil, if you want.
Well, that sounds good. And that's a recipe. That's one way of cooking it.
Yes. Very, very traditional Italian way.
All right. Well, this is fantastic to get these nice, earthy, simple recipes for these wonderful, wonderful vegetables this time of year.
My favorite way to go.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Evan Kleiman. She is the host of this fine show, and she's at the market today, and she's having way too much fun talking to the farmers and picking things up and looking them over. So it's always great to see you, Evan. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Well, we've just gone shopping, but let's not cook right away. Instead, let's go out to eat. It's almost lunchtime, so let's see what local omnivore Jonathan Gold's been eating lately. That's when good food returns. Hungry? Do you know what you're going to eat? Maybe you'll find out in the next couple of minutes, because Jonathan Gold, intrepid writer for the LA Weekly, author of many counterintelligence columns, is here with us this morning to give us a treat. Where are we going?
Here we are in Alhambra.
Alhambra. And what's the place called?
It's a brand new restaurant called The Kitchen, which is a branch of a place in Millbrae. And it serves what is my favorite dim sum in town at the moment.
You're kidding.
No.
Why is it your favorite?
It's not the most imaginative dim sum. That would probably be Sea Harbor. And it's not the most beautiful dim sum, which is at Mission 261. But it is the freshest. In other words, you get the rolled rice noodles around shrimp, and the noodles are just gooey and luscious. You get those fried sticky rice things stuffed with pork, and those fried globes of sticky rice are just glorious. They're crisp, and they're chewy, and they're pulley, and they're slightly sweet, and they haven't yet succumbed to that soddenness.
The steam table death roll.
Exactly so.
Explain a bit of dim sum etiquette to me for people who have never been or don't go a lot. Where do you start? Is there a particular order that you approach things?
I don't think so. You sit down, the waiter comes over, he'll ask you what kind of tea you want, or he should ask you what kind of tea you want. Jasmine tea is a perfectly good one. Chrysanthemum, my wife loves. I love something called Pu'er, which tastes like dirt, but like the best dirt in the world.
Yeah, I love that.
And then you start grabbing off whatever's closest to you. At this place, they give you a sheet and you tick off what you want.
Is it in English?
Finally, it is. The first three times I went, it was only in Cantonese. The waiters were sort of chuckling over it. As you well know, I'm very much a chicken foot and tripe and jellyfish head kind of guy. it forced me to order the things that I actually know how to order. But now the menu is translated, so you don't have to worry about it. You can look down and you can see baked barbecue pork buns and you say, I want that. In fact, you do want it because it's a really good baked barbecue pork bun. Some of their unusual things are fried taro nests that have a quail egg nestled inside.
A taro nest. And so it's a nest made out of
shredded
taro tuber.
That's been deep fried. And when they deep fry it, you know, embedded inside the meat of the taro is a quail egg.
Oh, that's beautiful.
They have those rice noodle rolls, not only with the usual shrimp and beef, but with scallops and scallions, which is just delicious. They have fried rice noodles that have been dyed green with green tea and sugared and stuffed with coconut and peanuts instead of meat. And those are...
That sounds unbelievable.
It's so good. You want to eat like 1,000 of them.
Well, what is the number of people you think should go together to a dim sum restaurant?
I would say that I went yesterday with 18 people. But I've also been with, you know, just myself and one other person and had a great time. So there's no set number. It's actually incredibly inexpensive if you go with a lot of people because you end up ordering everything on the menu even with you're with one other person. But this way there are enough people to eat what you actually get.
And dim sum is usually a morning thing?
Yes. 11 and 1 is the shank of the dim sum experience.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It sounds like a wonderful place. Could
you
tell us once again the name of the restaurant and where it is?
The name of the restaurant is The Kitchen, and it is at 203 West Valley Boulevard in Alhambra.
That was Jonathan Gold, author of countless counterintelligence columns in the LA Weekly. If you listen to the show regularly, you'll know what kinds of places I like to eat at. I'd rather find something delicious in an empty restaurant then make sure to get the best table at the newest hotspot. But for those in the Hollywood elite and those trying to be, choosing the right restaurant is extremely important. And often it's not just about how good the food is. I'll be back with an observer of the eating habits of Hollywood when Good Food returns. Hollywood is ruled by a fear of food, says Variety food blog editor Dana Harris. It's a love-hate kind of thing. Restaurants where power agents and celebs do lunch are vital to the survival of the industry. But these are the very people who can't gain even a few pounds without it jeopardizing their careers. The Knife blog offers a unique perspective on the world where food and entertainment collide. Welcome, Dana.
Hi, thank you.
So is breakfast still the major power meeting?
Breakfast is still one of the primary spots where you're going to be able to do business. I think we've gotten a little bit away from that point where it was I can eat less than you can, you know, in terms of, you know, I can have one slice of toast. Well, I can have my toast without butter. But at the same time, breakfast meetings, I think, are known as sort of what is done most easily because you just get it over with. It's done.
Are there certain requirements for a restaurant to become a key space for entertainment meetings?
There are several aspects that make a restaurant really work for the entertainment industry. And it usually has very little to do with food. It has everything to do with location in terms of being a reasonable distance to where most people work, which is mostly Beverly Hills. It has everything to do with parking in terms of valet service, service inside the restaurant, and also a sense of that who else is going to be there, which is why the grill is so popular. It's become such a hub for so many elements of the industry, especially the agents, that it's just you get to kill that many more birds with your stones. You get to go in there, and it's like if you're not only having lunch with the producer across from you, but you're also being seen by this producer, that producer, that studio exec, that agent.
It's amazing. It's like choreographed performances by people who are normally not in front of the camera.
Yeah, there's I think there's very much a sense in the industry of being seen, even though you have absolutely no interest in ever being an actor or actress, but you have to be seen. If you aren't seen, it's almost as if you don't exist.
Do you know of any instances where this being so much in the public makes things devolve, or a meeting that you had great hopes for all of a sudden completely disappears in front of your eyes just because someone else is in the next booth and you see the thing that you've been working on going on next to you?
Well, it's funny. It's not usually, but I mean, there are definitely examples in which that happens. We're working on a story now about agency poaching. And one of the anecdotes is agents who are preparing to go, you know, hopefully poach a client. They're meeting this client at this restaurant. And they walk in and they look around and they see an agent who belongs to the agency that the client is currently at. They turn around and go out. You know, in that kind of circumstances, yes. You know, if you see that, oh, my God, I'm trying to get away with doing something, I'm going to have witnesses, I have to leave. So, yes, that does happen.
Now, what about how the actual food and wine come into play? Are they in play as status items, or does the fact that so many of the actors, the people that do have to be in front of the camera, they're constantly on some sort of a regime, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. How does this need for status play into the need for physical beauty?
Well, really, they're two different things. But they're both, you know, vital elements. I mean, to take, for instance, the dieting aspect, the on-the-side syndrome.
What do you mean by the on-the-side syndrome?
Everything on the side. Here's the sauce on the side. Here's the dressing on the side. You know, it's just everything is, you know, if there's some way to separate the things that have the highest number of fat grams away from the rest of my plate, let's please do that. You know, I personally will do anything, move heaven and earth to not do breakfast meetings at this point in my career.
Why?
Because I got so burned out on them. When I first started, I literally had breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the first 6 months. That was my editor's instruction. I do not want you to have an empty space on your calendar for the next 6 months. You need to get to know the town. And that's how you do it. You go out to eat. So to answer your question about what people do for, you know, the status versus the diet, there's the whole dieting thing, which people try to have the blandest, the plainest, you know, which just blows my mind. I can't imagine. Doesn't seem like a life worth living. And most of these restaurants, as you were saying, what makes a hot restaurant, know how to accommodate this and will move heaven and earth to accommodate it. So they're never going to give you attitude because you don't want it the way the chef has done it. In terms of the status element, that happens a lot more at the higher levels of the industry, partially because they can afford it. And I think at that point they don't, you know, in a way, the whole worrying about what's on your plate and what that says about you, that's kind of sort of – there's something baby agent about the whole thing in terms of being so concerned because you just don't know what's going to make a difference. You just try everything.
Give us an idea of what the old line Hollywood places that are just standard and still going on are, and maybe some new up-and-comers.
Okay. The standards, the Grill, of course. I'll be very curious to see what happens with the Grill, though, when CAA and ICM move next year.
And where are they moving to?
Century City. If there's somebody who's saying, gosh, you know, I want to open a neat restaurant in L.A. and I just don't know where to do it, Century City. That place is a wasteland. It is so desperate for good restaurants. And there is going to be such a power center there in terms of you've got, you know, MGM there, you've got CAA there, you've got ICM there. They're all going to be there. They're, you know, not they can't always eat at the Peninsula.
So interesting, because here in L.A., I think less than in other cities, you don't usually think about a hotel dining room.
Hotel dining rooms are key in Hollywood. Four Seasons, Peninsula, Regent Beverly Wilshire, Cut in terms of being a new power spot, that's incredibly popular.
Now, where is Cut?
Cut is at the Regent Beverly Wilshire. It's where you're going to be seen. It's got the right food. It's got, you know, it's Wolfgang Puck, who's like, you know, the house chef.
This has been so much fun, Dana. We're going to have you come back and do some more dish for us.
Fabulous.
Dana Harris is the editor of The Knife, Variety's food blog. I've got the address online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, I don't know if Hollywood types have gotten into the artisan food movement. The latest food to be making a handmade comeback is salami, and we are so lucky for it. I want to introduce you next to a gifted chef who's making salami one log at a time.
Good Food on KCRW. We'll be right back. Notice that salami isn't just Hebrew National or even Colombo anymore. Just as we've seen with bread and cheese, salami's the latest food item to get specialized artisanal treatment. Its name even changes sometimes to salumi. With us today is one of the artisans responsible for this shift to salumi. He's Paul Bertoli, noted chef at one time of Chez Panisse and Olivetto, and he's focusing his time as cure master of Framani handcrafted salumi in Berkeley, California. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's talk about the nomenclature. What is the difference between salumi and salami?
Salumi is analogous to the word charcuterie in French, which most people are, I think, more accustomed to hearing. Salumi is the general term for cured meats. In Italy, they're made primarily from pork. The root of the word comes from the word for salt, sal, or sale in Italian, and it means salted preserved meats.
And what is the primary difference between these gorgeous pieces of cured meat I see in front of me and a more commercial version of Italian salamis?
I think that in we don't use the word artisan lightly. The artisan tradition of making these products goes back to the farmhouse traditions of Italy, where animals were raised on the farm and usually fed a family or a group of families throughout the year. So the animals were tended with care. They were fed well. The products were handmade, that they were either hand-chopped or with the use of rudimentary mechanical tools like grinders that you could turn by hand, stuffed with horns into animal intestines and fermented and hung in the air to age and dry. We're following these very, you know, simple principles that go way back to Greek and Roman times, if you trace it back. We're not reinventing anything. We're simply bringing back an old way that we think is extremely valid, especially now. So the source of the meat is critical.
So where do you get your pork?
We source all of our pork from small Midwest family farms in Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota.
Are there varieties of pig that you prefer more than others?
Yes, but I'm not of the school of cherry-picking the Berkshire breed or, you know, give me the Old Spot only. That's all I want. I think that goes more towards restaurateurs who are interested in unusual varieties and noting those differences in their restaurant. What I'm looking for is a very flavorful hog of a certain age that has a certain lean-to-fat composition that's been fed corn and soy and never antibiotics or hormones. They're not necessary when you raise hogs out of doors.
And then are different parts of the animal used for different kinds of salamis?
Yes. We're looking at five different types in front of us right here. And for instance, the Toscano salami that you spoke about before is made from all the leg muscles and results in a certain texture, a certain color.
It tends to be a sort of burgundy red color with big chunks of fat in it, yet it's not a fatty salami.
Right. Yes, it's important, I think, for customers in the United States who are, I think, a little bit squeamish about seeing fat, not to put too much in the formula. I mean, we use about 18 to 22% fat, which is on the low side.
Now, when you first started, I remember reading your cookbooks, sort of watching your experiments with cured meats. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, you really have to take a leap of faith that what you're doing is correct. And that whole fermentation that sort of miraculously changes the meat and makes it edible for so long. Could you tell us a little bit about what that journey was like for you?
Well, I think it's something like analogous to winemaking or cheesemaking. The fermentation process is something that I had to learn all about. And I did that by traveling to Italy and working in old cellars and working with norcinos, traditional roaming pork butchers who went from farm to farm to put up the cured meats for families throughout Italy. So I went there and I learned the old ways, but then I came back and I spent some time at Iowa State University in their meat science program to make sure I understood the chemistry of the fermentation and the critical points that need to be observed when you're making these products, because they're shelf stable now once they're fully fermented and aged. But there are health issues. There's food safety issues when you're dealing with raw meat, because it's never cooked. This is just fermented and dried.
And cured. Mm-hmm. When does the first sort of miraculous change take place that mm-hmm. that grabs you, when you've taken the raw meat and you've ground it or chopped it so it's in the format you want and stuffed it into its casing, and then you hang it? I would imagine there's a certain time period where all of a sudden it changes.
Yes, it happens for my plant and with these products within the first 48 to 60 hours.
Wow.
And what I do is I inoculate the meat with cultures, something like yogurt or cheese, where it's a lactobacillus culture. And what that does is it denatures the protein and causes the water in the meat to be given up. So that's accompanied by a pH drop. So there's more acid in the meat, and that's what works on the protein. The acid works on the protein to denature it and to cause it to sort of firm up. So when you come into the fermentation room after 48 to 60 hours, you see something that doesn't resemble what you put in the casing. It's swollen and it's starting to drip. You know, that means it's giving up the water. So that's the first passage, really.
Do you have to do anything else to it after that? Are they bathed again in salt? Are they rubbed? Are they sprayed?
What we're doing at that fermentation step also is we're growing the mold culture on the outside. There's a beneficial mold, which is a penicillin mold, that populate the casing. You'll notice it as a sort of a white covering, or bluish gray, or sometimes even slightly orangish. And what the mold does is it helps to dry the sausage evenly by consuming some of the moisture at the surface. It also flavors the meat inside. You know, so it's very, very important for the protein fat breakdown and for flavor development.
So give me an idea of what you like after these have left your house and they come to our house. How should we be eating them?
Right. In Italy, the tradition is really to enjoy these as an antipasto. They're kind of a riotous food in the beginning of the meal. They pique the appetite because they have salt, they have acid. They're very pleasing because of the fermentation aromas and whatnot. They just seem to bring out the appetite in people. So I think that they should be served in the beginning of a meal on a platter in the middle of a table, enjoyed by friends with good wine and bread.
Thank you so much, Paul.
You're very welcome.
Paul Bertoli is the cure master and founder of Fra Mani Handcrafted Salumi in Berkeley. You can find his products at the Cheese Store of Silver Lake, Artisan Cheese Gallery in Studio City, and some Whole Foods markets. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a link and more information. There's one American foodstuff that's probably not going to generate an artisan movement. It's the Twinkie. That yellow-colored tube filled with white cream is so processed it has a half-life similar to polonium. In fact, there's some Twinkies in a science classroom in Washington that are from 1989, and they look pretty good. But if you're raising a vegan child, there's no way
will ever get to taste one of those creamy wonders, unless your mom is my next guest. She's perfected the vegan Twinkie. Did you have sort of an aha moment about lunchtime and what lunchtime was going to be for your child?
Well, you know, when I first started getting ready for James to go into first grade, I realized I'm going to have to pack a lunch, and we've never had cold lunches before. We've always eaten at home. And I thought, okay, what am I going to do here? I can't just be peanut butter and jelly every day. But I was really drawing a blank, so actually I went to the expert on James' lunch. I went to James, and I said, James, I'm going to pack you a cold lunch. What do you want? And he said, sushi. So, something that I would never have thought of. Him asking for sushi really broke me out of my constraints and opened up my eyes to what the possibilities were. So after that, I just started, you know, bouncing ideas off of him and writing my ideas down and thought, well, I could make this into a daily blog. I'll just take a picture because it looks so adorable and talk about what he thinks about the food I make.
So when he went to school and he opened up this lunchbox filled with vegetarian sushi, did he get some reviews from the crowd?
There were a lot of interesting questions, like, what's that?
Now, what about the first time somebody waved a Twinkie in front of his nose? Did he come home and say, Mom?
Well, I was actually there. I volunteered at the school once a week, and his friend had packed a little Hostess snack, and he was eating it and going, this is so good. James, have you had a Twinkie? And James just turned, and he looked at me with this little question in his eyes, and I said, you haven't had one, but I'll make you one. So immediately my brain starts thinking, okay, I got to make a vegan Twinkie. How am I going to do this?
So what was the first thing you did in terms of, a Twinkie's not a Twinkie without that shape.
Right. So I started thinking, okay, mini loaf pans, could I shape something, could I cut it? And then I went shopping and realized you can actually buy pans. They're called cream canoe pans. The one I bought was actually a Hostess Twinkie baking set.
Given that you're making a cupcake with no egg and no butter, tell us what the ingredients are.
Okay, well, you've got just plain white flour, and I used a soy buttermilk. So I used plain soy milk and added some apple cider vinegar to it to give it a kind of buttermilky quality, and then baking powder, baking soda, a little bit of salt, some sugar and oil, and then vanilla and coconut extract.
Now, what about the cream filling?
That was just a frosting that I made, and I wanted it to taste a little bit marshmallowy, so I added some barley malt powder, which I think gives it that nice malted marshmallowy flavor, and it's just basically like a buttercream frosting.
But there's no butter.
Right. I use a non-hydrogenated margarine called Earth Balance.
For those of us who have never used a non-hydrogenated margarine, is the texture similar or is it softer?
You know, it is a little bit softer.
But then you just fluff it up. You beat it until it's super, super fluffy.
Exactly.
And then how do you get the cream in there so it has the same three little dots that a traditional Twinkie has?
Yeah, I just use a pastry bag fitted with a little star tip and just jam it in.
Did you find that the adults in your life were sort of filching these as much as your child?
Yeah. You know, when I posted the recipe, someone said, do these freeze well? I'm like, we have no idea. We ate them. I think they were gone in 48 hours.
There's something about that shape that before you even bite into it, it's already comforting because of all the associations.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've even rolled them in chocolate, too.
Mm. I noticed I spent some time on both your blogs, Vegan Lunchbox and also Schmood Food. And your inventory of recipes is just really astounding. But one can definitely see that you have sweet tooth.
Oh, I know I do. It really shows.
Now, I also have to say that you should win an award for how you pack these lunches. Because going on your blog, it's quite beautiful, the little box that it's in. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that lunch box is called a laptop lunch system, and it's sold online at laptoplunches.com. It's really a cute little box, and each little container fits inside in its own segment, and then instead of separate lids, the whole container just folds over on itself to make one lid, which is lovely because I found when you send your child off to school, they don't always come back with all the pieces.
Well, Jennifer, I want to thank you so much. Even as a non-vegan, I have to tell you, your recipe sounds so good, I might have to try a couple of them.
Well, thank you. I hope you do.
Jennifer McCann is the creator of the veganlunchbox.com. There's a cute and functional lunchbox there that you should check out, too. There's a lot of cooking that doesn't take quite so much deconstruction as that Twinkie. Like, I'd bet you wouldn't guess that making perfect bread at home would be so easy. But it is. The man who brought us the world's simplest and most foolproof bread recipe is with me next on Good Food. Those weeks where I couldn't find the time to read the New York Times dining section, typically a highlight of my week. But as I continued to peruse the front page of the paper each day on my laptop, I noticed that among the top 10 most emailed articles was Mark Bittman's take on a no-knead bread. I kept tracking the article, and it never left the top 10. For weeks, it seemed like. Then I started hearing about people I know making the bread and feeling like they had reached a sort of culinary nirvana. So what could I do? We had to ask Mark, author of the New York Times Minimalist Recipe Column and the wildly popular How to Cook Everything, to come by and share the story of the no-knead bread. Mark, describe what this bread is and why you feel like it has captured everyone's imagination.
This bread is truly a no-knead bread. It's captured everybody's imagination because it works and because those of us who have worked on making good European-style bread at home for 30 or 40 years, as people my age have done, and constantly feel like we're climbing this ladder towards something approaching decent or perfect or whatever, we're suddenly thrown for a loop by this bread that takes no work and is, like, unbelievable.
Okay, so where did you learn this new technique?
This is technique was put together by this guy, Jim Leahy, who owns Sullivan Street Bakery, which is a bakery in New York, who sent me an email that said, I have this technique for bread that a kid could do and will produce better bread with no work than most bakeries in the city, including my own. So, you want to hear them?
I definitely want to hear them.
One, he makes a very, very wet dough, almost as wet as a starter, which if you make bread, you know a starter is too wet to handle. There's a lot of water in there. I mean, to wit, I've adapted the recipe a little bit, but at this point, I'm now using 4 cups of flour and 2 cups of water. He uses very, very little yeast, 1/4 teaspoon. To compensate for that, his rising times are really, really long. So you mix this wet batter with a little bit of yeast, and it's just flour, water, salt, yeast. And then you let it sit for about 18 hours. And it's less if...
I love that throwaway line.
Then you walk away from it.
Then you let it sit for 18 hours. Now, does it sit in the refrigerator or does it sit outside on a counter?
70 degrees is ideal. The yeast activates. Yeast breeds yeast. So over this long period of time, it does the equivalent of kneading, which is to say it creates gluten. It activates the gluten that's inherent in the flour.
What does this really long, slow rise with very little yeast do to the flavor of the bread?
It develops the good bready flavor of good bread. It tastes very wheaty, and it tastes a tiny bit sour, and it doesn't taste very yeasty. And when you add whole wheat, you really taste that. And when you add rye or cornmeal, it's out of this world. I mean, you really, really, those flavors come forward.
What does this really loose dough look like after the 18 hours?
So after 18 hours, it's bubbly and it's wet. It looks quite wet. And if you tilt the bowl or whatever you have it rising in, you'll see the long strands of gluten that you see when you make a starter. And that's really a cool thing to see. And you turn it out onto a floured counter and it looks much too wet to handle. But lo and behold, when you sprinkle it with a little bit of flour, it stays very, very soft and becomes not handleable in the sense that you could squeeze it, but handleable in the sense that you can just barely shape it. And that's what you want to do. You then shape it and you let it rest for another couple or 3 hours. Although there are people who are baking it almost straight after this, and I don't like those results as well, but it can be done. So then you wait another couple hours, and then – and this is the part that really gets people. Then you bake it in a covered pot.
I love this. This is like genius. So you – So you've risen it the second time, so it's at the point where if you touch it, it doesn't spring back, I would expect.
Not as much, right? It's not as resistant.
And then what do? Slide it off the counter and plop it in a pan?
You slide your hand underneath it. I mean, there's a couple different ways of doing this. But however you manage to do it, you plop this into a preheated, while the oven's preheating, you preheat a cast iron or a Le Creuset or a heavy pot with a cover. And you plop it into this preheated pot, and it looks a little bit like a mess. And you put the cover on the pot, and you cook it for 20 or 30 minutes that way. You take the cover off, and lo and behold, you have this beautifully rounded, formed bread. And then you bake it with the cover off for another 20 or 30 minutes until it's done, and it's gorgeous.
Is this the kind of bread you like to eat warm, or do you let it cool down?
You've got to let it cool down. It has to rest. I once read something by some old food writer about how the bread must rest before it is introduced to the knife.
You have to
wait a while before it's introduced to the knife.
And then describe the final product.
The final product, if you do 1/3 rye flour, is the closest thing I've seen to a Poilain bread.
Who is Poilain? Poilain
is this famous French baker who in the 80s, I guess, went back to the old recipes and developed a very dense bread with some rye flour in it that had a great crust. And so we're not talking about an elegant baguette. We're talking about a peasant loaf with a solid but not hard crust, crackly, the inside having those shiny, beautiful tunnels or cells of gluten, really, really good, well-developed flavor. It's perfectly shaped. I mean, that's the other thing. I cannot tell you how much time I've spent shaping boule. And then here's this thing which you plop into a pot and it looks awful and it comes out and it looks like, you know, you could charge $8 a loaf for this stuff.
Mark, thank you so much for being a purveyor of deliciousness.
You're welcome, Evan.
Mark Bittman's minimalist column in the New York Times is a must-read every Wednesday. Mark's also the author of the bestseller, How to Cook Everything. The bread recipe and its update will be on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. In order to create recipes for cookbooks, you have to do a lot of improvising. This way of cooking is often the most fun and the most rewarding. It's not hard to do if you understand some basic principles of flavors. I'll try and lead you down the path of intuition next when Good Food returns. Reputation from those who know me for being an improvisational cook. One friend even went so far as to call me the Jerry Garcia of food. What does that mean? It means that for me, great joy comes from cooking without recipes, just relying on my know-how and letting ingredients guide me. I love to riff. But to teach someone else how to do it, I wouldn't even have a clue. So that makes Sally Schneider's new book, The Improvisational Cook, a bit of a miracle to me. Sally actually went through her thought process as she riffed, and she wrote it all down. A prodigious effort, I must say. The end result is fascinating. Welcome, Sally.
Hey, Evan.
Do you think that improvising in the kitchen is something that's open to everyone, or do you think that it's best left to a more, let's say, seasoned cook?
I absolutely think it's open to everyone. Improvising involves a great deal, and the first and simplest thing it involves is an understanding of the internal logic of one recipe or one technique. So many people say, I don't know how things work. And so I've discovered that if you just give people that tool, a simple explanation, starting, if they're a basic cook, with a simple recipe, it can go from there.
Let's have an example. Take a basic recipe or basic technique and show us how it's possible to improvise on it.
Okay, I'll take one of my favorites, popcorn. Now, popcorn is something that everybody loves. The most common flavoring is melted butter. Melted butter is a really delicious liquid fat. So if you know that popcorn traditionally is flavored by pouring a really delicious liquid fat over it, then you can ask the question, what if I used other really delicious liquid fats? So first thought, what about bacon fat, you know, which is sort of devilish and over the top and astonishing. And then I thought, well, what about my favorite thing to do, which is to make quick flavored oils, which I just do by heating a set of flavorings in oil, say, for example, sage leaves and slivered garlic cloves until they're crispy. And then I have a sage and garlic flavored oil and the crispy bits to put on the popcorn. Or, for example, what about frying thin slices of shallot in peanut oil to make a shallot flavored oil with crispy little shallots, which are like crispy little onion rings. So you have kind of onion ring and popcorn thing. And then I thought, well, you know, what about white truffle oil, which is stuff I rarely use. But I thought, oh, wait a minute, on popcorn, this is where I could really get into it. So I poured some white truffle oil in melted butter or olive oil and made the most astonishing white truffle popcorn. So you get the idea, and I've done these kinds of improvisations with macaroni and cheese and meatloaf and all the sort of obvious stuff. And in the book, the way it works is I take a main recipe, one recipe that I think is really great for everybody to have as a recipe, and then I include a section called Understanding, which tells you the internal logic of the recipe and some ways to think about improvising. Then I give some sample improvisations that I've done just to give you an idea. You can use them as recipes or you can, you know, take them as ideas. And this way of presenting information seems to really help people get it and get going.
Why do you think people have so much fear about an act that for us is so natural?
I think that a lot of people these days didn't grow up hanging around a kitchen as I did. I think the perfection that we see on TV and the incredible control of chefs and, you know, home entertaining people and all of this have given the illusion that this is how it is. And in my experience, cooking is messy, doesn't have that perfect stylish thing going on.
I can't even imagine having perfection every single time I cook. I know at the restaurant we have the ritual burning of the crostini. It's like,
yes.
It's sort of like no catering job is complete
without
the crostini being burned at least one time.
Yes.
Relate to us some of the little quote mistakes that turn out not to really be mistakes that you've had that led you into another improvisation.
First, I just want to mention the most famous one these days, which is not mine, which was the molten chocolate cake that is on every restaurant dessert menu that everyone loves, was said to be discovered by a chef who decided to cut into a cake that they knew had been taken out of the oven too early, accidentally. And he thought he'd check it out anyway. And, you know, he cut it open and outspilled this incredible molten center. The popcorn I talked to you about is a really good example. The sage and garlic popcorn came from a failure, which was I thought it would be great if I fried white beans, cooked white beans. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to have these crispy white beans? And why don't I make a sage and garlic oil and fry them in the sage and garlic oil and then toss them with the crispy sage leaves? Well, in order to get white beans crispy when you're pan frying them. You have to cook them quite a while. And they just – they ended up being sort of chewy and – you know, I'm sort of standing there alone in my kitchen saying, well, you know, I'd eat these, but they're not great, and maybe I need to work on them more, you know, and I can call them popcorn beans. That'll be a good name. And then I thought, why should I work on them more? They're not that good. Why don't I just try pouring the sage and garlic oil on popcorn? And I did, and it was like, oh, yeah, this is really the great idea. So I let the popcorn bean, the hell with that. But it gave me, it took me on the path into something that I just love having discovered, which were these popcorns.
The Improvisational Cook is Sally Schneider's book. I hope you'll be inspired to follow your instinct in the kitchen this week. It's still time to enjoy some of those black truffles that Sally likes to add to her popcorn. When Good Food returns, I'll tell you more about the intense and unforgettable truffle. White truffles, those big, knobby fungi whose haunting aroma seems to dog gastronomes like no other specialty food. Despite all we know about them, there's still an air of mystery that we can't seem to solve. Joining us this morning is Peter McNee, executive chef at Pojo, a restaurant in the heart of Sausalito, California. Peter had the great fortune to travel to Alba, the heart of lightness, shall we say, of white truffles, to participate in the Great White Truffle Auction. Tell us what a truffle really is, just in case some people who are listening are thinking about the chocolate delicacy.
Quite different from the chocolate delicacy, in fact. And I would say maybe on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 times as great as the chocolate delicacy. And for those who love chocolates, I'm telling you, they're something special. These are, as you put it, fungi. They're also known as tubers because they grow underneath the ground as opposed to on top of the ground like a mushroom does. But as far as related to mushrooms, it's quite the same in the sense that wild mushrooms, just like truffles, we don't have the ability to cultivate them. And they just kind of grow in areas where they're going to grow. For instance, the white truffle, you won't see outside of Piemonte and Tuscany. You won't see them, you know, in France. You won't see them in Spain. You won't see them in the United States, for that matter. So it's something special. And the fragrance and the taste of a white truffle is quite unlike anything else out there.
Having said that, try and describe it.
It's a white truffle's something that all you're really going to do is shave it over something that has egg, butter, pasta, in order to be able to have the aroma of the truffle show up, really, really evolve on the dish. And it has kind of a garlicky, earthy, and then the last way to describe it really is a truffle flavor. It's been described as an aphrodisiac. It's one of those smells that when you smell it, it hits you right in the chest.
Now, could you compare the smell and taste to a black truffle?
White are a little more subtle and a little more fragile. And the scent, the aroma of a white truffle just shaved over a dish is a lot stronger and a lot more overpowering compared to a black truffle. Black truffle, you want to maybe cook with, you want to put underneath the skin of a fowl when you're cooking it, and that'll show up as it's cooking. My experience with black truffles is there's a little more dirt and earth and a little less of that really phenomenal garlicky truffle scent to them.
Well, that's a good description. Now, how are they harvested? How are they found?
Well, back in the day, you always hear that they were found by pigs. My experience is that everybody's made the switch to dogs.
Once they're harvested, what are the size variations?
They can be extremely small, and those are not coveted, and those tend to fetch a smaller price. and I would describe that as maybe a marble size. But then you can find them depending there's always auctions throughout the year, and you'll see truffles that are the size of apples fetching extreme amounts of money. I mean,
give us an idea of how much money is extreme.
At some point, there'll be a truffle that is just enormous, which will fetch, you know, upwards of $100,000 or so. It's unbelievable when you see what it fetches. And it's because someone in the world, whether it's in Europe or America or Japan for that matter, wants the recognition of buying the largest truffle.
Now, how do they need to be stored and then prepped before they're used in a dish?
Well, truffles are extremely fragile. You want to keep them always cold. And it's really important if you can, which is hard in the United States, but having worked in Italy, you want to keep the dirt on them as long as possible because that'll just keep them to last a little longer. However, when you do get them in the United States, and for instance, we brought truffles home with us, we cleaned those vigorously to remove any and all dirt because it's a big no-no to be bringing dirt from anywhere outside the United States in the United States because of the whole bovine thing.
What about truffle oil? How is that made? And what do you use it for?
Truffle oil, I use it for nothing. I'm not a big fan of the truffle oil. Truffle
and why
butter
is that?
I think a number of the truffle oils out there have either little or no truffle in them, and then they're made chemically. The scent is just like a perfume is. Also, almost every experience I've had with eating truffle oil, it will taste great, but later on, it's the kind of food that shows up. It sounds disgusting, but you keep being reminded of it hours and hours later because the grease and the fat and the oil, I just have a tendency to keep burping it. And it's not a pleasant reminder. But when you're eating perfect truffles shaved over a dish, that's not what you get. You get nothing but the flavor of the truffles, and the dish is perfectly balanced.
On this trip that you made where the restaurant actually sent you to meet with dealers and bring back the truffles, how do you choose which ones you want to bid on?
What we did, we didn't bid on the truffles. We just picked one of the truffle hunters to source our truffles.
And how much did you pay?
For us this year, it was about between $1,800 and $2,000 a pound.
Wow.
Which is pretty breathtaking.
So when you were bringing them back home, was that sort of a like a stealthy sort of contraband thing, or did you proudly just parade them right through customs?
This is like one of those instances where I'd like to claim the fifth. We did a good job. We brought them home, and our clientele at the restaurant were very thankful that we had done that.
Peter, it's been so much fun talking with you. Thanks a lot.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
I've been speaking with Peter McNee. He's the executive chef of Pojo, a restaurant in Sausalito, California. They did a special truffle dinner with truffles that Peter brought back from Italy personally. You can find out all the info from today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. The show can be podcast, too. Go to iTunes or KCRW for details. Don't forget to check out our new video podcasts. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Priya Fenimore, and Holly Tarson. I'm Evan Kleinman. I hope you'll tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.